This is Edge Cases, a podcast about mostly Apple-related software development, featuring myself and my co-host, the Donnie and Marie of Objective-C. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 31. It's Saturday, January 5th, 2013. And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Microsoft's Singularity OS.
Microsoft's Singularity OS. That should be interesting. Okay, so I don't have any follow-up. Do you have any follow-up,
Wolf? I have follow-up in the form of a correction. I forget, I think it was the, if I actually had the show notes up in front of me, I could tell you this, but I think it was the last episode that I talked, so I guess that would be two episodes ago. It's two episodes again, because I was talking about squirting code across address spaces, episode number 29.
Indeed you were.
And I think I talked a little bit about Mach in that episode, and Chris Hansen wrote in a tweet, a correction, and I'll quote him here. Mach was created to break an OS into cooperating servers, a file system, virtual memory network devices, not for personalities. And if I gave the impression that Mach existed solely for the idea of offering different operating system personalities, that is, of course, totally wrong. It did actually offer, it has a BSD personality on top of it, so that was something that was later, but that was not the driving force behind it. So I'm glad that Chris Hansen cleared that up.
Yes, Chris Hansen, longtime listener for the podcast.
Oh, really? Really? How do you know that?
He's contacted me before with corrections. So yes.
Okay, great.
There you go. And the corrections have been right. So kudos to Mr. Hansen. May he keep correcting us for the entirety of the podcast.
Oh, we won't make any more mistakes, I'm sure.
Oh boy. No, of course not. Yeah, that's because that was what the holiday break was for, right? It was
right,
for us to sweep out all the mistakes, and now we're back, and now we'll be perfect.
Yeah. Okay, so do you have any corrections or follow-up?
I do not.
Okay.
Take it away.
Okay, then we can again get right into it. So I was trying to think of what would be a good topic for kind of the first episode of 2013. And I was thinking maybe a retrospective kind of looking back at what type of things have dropped in 2012 and what type of things we'd like to see in 2013. And I don't know, it was a more kind of depressing the type of stuff that came out in 2012. Hadn't made too much progress. Instead, what I thought would be a little bit better is kind of with the idea of like fresh starts in mind, all that, is that kind of I would talk about computers and I guess that includes desktops and mobile devices, cell phones now, well, smartphones, and kind of start at the basis and work our way up where I can kind of talk about like where we're at and what I think the future lies, and if we could do it all over again, like reboot the system as it were, like what type of things would we have? Kind of a not really blue sky, because a lot of the stuff that I'd like to talk about is proven, and or at least is at least off the whiteboard and has real implemented systems behind it, but the kind of stuff that is not the type of systems we deal with today, and so. Kind of at the base of the software pyramid, the software stack is the operating system, since that's the software that runs software, right? So I figured I would talk a little bit about what I'm excited about, and in terms of kind of operating system state of the art.
Well, if I could just before you get started,
sure.
Just the idea of a Microsoft singularity does make me a little worried.
It's because you lived through the Microsoft is Borg 90s, right? So you're used to this.
Yes.
The kids today, they don't know what it was like when Microsoft was ruling it all. And I mean, Apple's kind of the Microsoft of today's age, where they're kind of rolling
really
over
is,
everyone.
Yeah,
it's pretty scary. But yeah, it's
well, the Apple singularity does not fill me with any more joy, really.
Yeah, it's definitely trade-off city there.
But anyway, continue.
Yeah. So, interesting thing is that, there was this paper, it's a set of slides, I guess. I think I saw it a couple years back. And it's basically, operating systems have really kind of stagnated. It's, I think a lot of people kind of assume it's like a solved problem. And so the innovation you tend to see in software tends to be below the operating systems and above the operating systems. So we talked a little bit, you know, apparently two episodes ago, about how Mach had the idea of, you know, different processes implementing different parts of the operating system and how it could even offer simultaneous personalities and stuff like that. And those kind of like heyday, you know, wild operating system years are beyond, are past, we're way past that. Now it's like, it's what is going on underneath the operating systems in terms of like VMware and hypervisors type stuff, which you can have multiple VMware instances, virtualized machines going all at the same time, that a lot of research and like, you know, new instructions are being added to processors, new capabilities. And of course, above that, in terms of operating systems, it's like, oh, you got this dumb OS layer that's, you know, a poorly debugged set of device drivers. And it's, we'll put all the, you know, great new messaging, object stuff, functional stuff, all on top of that. So really, it's like, it's actually quite depressing because, you know, basically it's people just assuming that what we have today is the way it should be, which is, you know, essentially Unix. And it's
right.
And I really get the impression that people have given up. Like, they think there's nothing here, that this is the way, this way computers are, that this is Unix, Unix is one, and you can have slightly different variants, but yeah, this is how computers work. And this, of course, could be, you know, nothing further from the truth, but it's just, you know, people have given up. So I want to talk a little bit about the type of innovation that is happening in operating system research. And I think pretty much the shining example comes out of Microsoft on this. And that's, so they have this operating system called Singularity, which I agree with you, I think it's a bit of a unfortunate name, mostly because when you Google for it, it ends up, you come up with a bunch of pseudoscience. But actually, you know, we probably should do an edge cases episode debunking the Singularity. Although, actually, you know, I got to back off here, man. Maybe you're just a subscriber. I don't know. Do you buy into the Singularity?
I find some of what I have read about it to be a bit hard to swallow.
Okay.
But I also think it's probably beyond the scope of a programming show.
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, we've talked about other topics out of our ass, so, you know, who knows, maybe we can do this too.
Okay. But anyway, yes, so unfortunate name, but it's a really cool operating system project. So I want to talk a little bit about what makes it different from the operating system that's under your iOS or Mac OS X or what have you. And the interesting thing about Singularity is that it's actually a set of things. But if I had to pick a technology,
wait, there isn't just one Singularity.
Is he already? It's not. I think they should name it Singleton, right? So there's only one of them. Yes, there's a set of the good things about it.
Okay.
And the if you think about what operating systems do, and they tends to be like, you know, the kind of division between the microkernel and the monolithic kernel type stuff, and we talked a little bit about how Mach is the microkernel operating system, and I'm still big fan of the microkernel kind of message passing ideas here. And Singularity actually takes it in a very interesting way. If I had to pick a technology that is probably really going to kind of like redefine how software is built over the next, I don't know, decade, I think more and more static analysis is going to show up in force. And actually it already has, but I think it's going to become more and more prevalent to the point where it's like, we'll look upon today's systems like, oh my God, they actually were running on a pre-static analysis of days, which is kind of crazy. So the static analysis, it's multifaceted in different levels. But as static analysis, that as Xcode Workaday programmers, we'd run into this. Of course, it's Clang, and it's static analysis. And now that I think about it, I think Arc pretty much hinges on static analysis as well. So it can analyze how you use a resource and can decide whether it should release it or can you keep on retaining it or what have you.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. So static analysis, that would be at the language level. But also there's static analysis at the instruction level. And so a example of static analysis at the instruction level would be something like Google's native client, which is a way to run x86 binaries at near full speed. I think actually at full speed, if not, you know, maybe 1% slower or something like that, but in a safe way. So the idea is that I can give you an x86 binary or executable, and you can run it, and you can run it safely. So it doesn't have to be like interpreted or even just-in-time compiled to like a native instruction set from the intermediate representation. And how it does it is actually takes advantage of x86 insane programming model. And they play games with like segment registers that I don't quite understand. And it really, I hope I never understand it because it's pretty esoteric. But they are able to quickly, basically, I think they might, I know in the ARM, so there's an ARM implementation of Google's native client as well. And unfortunately, or fortunately in my book, ARM does not have these segment register tricks. So they have to do a instruction level scanning there. But that's actually a little bit more easier to understand because it is a pure software model there. So basically what they do is they scan the instructions and they analyze them and they make sure that a few things don't happen. Like they make sure how you take addresses, that you're not moving the program counter into like the middle of another instruction, because that'd be a good way to make make code look like data or data look like code. And so it's a quick little scan that goes through that. This makes sure that your program is well behaved, that's not trying to read outside its boundaries of where it should be reading, and that it's not doing anything weird. And so that type of static analysis is relatively inexpensive. And like I said, on the x86 architecture, they're making it essentially free. And it's a little bit of a hit on ARM. But
well, it sounds like, so you said that it evaluates where program execution is going. It probably needs to evaluate what memory you're accessing.
Right.
But it certainly can't do too much beyond that, too much beyond something very, very simple, or you would just need a lot more smarts, and then it wouldn't be, you know, we need to be able to predict multiple instructions ahead. And it sounds like, due to the speed thing, that they're not doing that.
Right, right. It pretty much is. Yeah, it's not a runtime thing. It's a static, ahead of time type of thing. And there's a kind of like this blind spot in the industry, and it's kind of from the computer science background, in that, I don't know, it's just like the Turing frights or something, that you kind of like you learn about the halting problem, and you're like, oh, yes. you can't, a program can't look at another program and tell you whether it ever halt, and we're like, okay, program analysis is impossible, and you just go on your merry way, and you kind of just assume that that's just something that doesn't, we're not allowed. And it turns out there's all sorts of static analysis you can do that is very useful that we just haven't really been doing. So it's a useful technique that Singularity takes advantage of. And so how Singularity works is that it's able to take these programs that are I should restart. So Singularity is an operating system written in a language called Sing Sharp, which is an extension of a language called Spec Sharp, which is an extension of a language that you probably know about, C Sharp. So there's a couple extensions there. I'll go through each one. So C Sharp is obviously Microsoft's kind of standard language. It's Java fighter and probably killer. I don't know. Depends on who you talk to. But
oh, Java will never die.
Got that right. And the Spec Sharp, whatever episode that was when I talked about design by contract. So you have preconditions, post-conditions, invariants, that type of stuff, the Eiffel type stuff we're talking about. Uh-huh. So that's what Spec Sharp adds to C Sharp. So basically,
it's an Eiffel killer,
pretty much. And I mean, depends on who you talk to. Which is, you know, Eiffel was, I think there's Eiffel Studio, which is actually a Windows program. So they were definitely targeting, you know, kind of the Windows crowd there. At least the people who ran Windows, which admittedly is the most people, so probably smarter than them. But yeah. So Spec Sharp was basically C Sharp with contracts. And Sing Sharp is a very interesting take on this, which adds yet another layer. And it adds contracts, but to a thing called channels, which essentially it makes communications a first-class citizen. So when you look at like how software systems interact, it's usually in terms of like sending messages to each other. And what Sync Sharp allows you to do is you can actually codify like how your communication system should operate, basically the state machine on an object. Like, if, for example, if an object represented a file, like, well, in order to, first you have to open the file, and then you can read and write from it, and then you have to close it. And so that you can obviously be expressed as a simple state machine there, going from the closed state to the open state, and what messages, what events it has received to go to transition from state to state. So that type of state machine is actually declared inside using Sync Sharp. So all the kind of low-level kind of stuff that we just assume that it would work, they actually codify. And so they can, by giving all this information in terms of the contracts of Spec Sharp and the contracts of communication in Sync Sharp, they can apply all sorts of interesting static analysis. Now, remember that C Sharp is a managed language, it's a type-safe language. So they already have a bunch of, you know, it's not just C where everything's a pointer and you can just walk bytes. It has a lot of metadata there, and you're not allowed to touch this random memory. So they can point this all together. They're able to do some really cool static analysis stuff where they can analyze the binary, which will be shipped to you in MSIL, Microsoft Intermediate Language, and they will analyze it. And when they're doing the, I think they do a generation from the MSIL to native code, which would be in this case the x86. They can do things like they can guarantee that this code will operate correctly, will behave correctly. So kind of like Google Native Client makes that kind of guarantee. Singularity will check this out and enforce it. And what this ends up doing is that because of the guarantees that the verifier can make, that the need for runtime process isolation that we know of as terms of, you know, each process on our Mac or our iPhone runs in separate address spaces, that there are no address spaces, that there's basically ring zero. It's thus the kernel level address space, and they run everything in that. And it's because it's safe, you don't need to do a runtime verification, or, you know, you don't have to put these fences all up between everything, which with the associated contextual switch times and the performance degradation that all these address spaces entail.
Well, they're saying that they don't think you can make memory errors either?
Right. You can't make memory errors.
Oh, come on. Yeah. Well, what about if you run off the end, you know, you have a loop that runs forever. I don't know. I guess.
Well, it's different from, you know, this is obviously you can write a loop that runs forever, right? That's different than memory errors or touching things that don't belong to you.
Well, right. So I guess the idea being that since you can't touch arbitrary amounts of memory, that if you try to run off the end of a bit of memory by going through a loop on it, that the runtime will crash it, will catch it.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yep.
But I'm not sure that because the other side of it, though, is that you don't want malicious code to run. And if they're relying on the people who the compilers to handle this sort of thing, and somebody crafts a malicious binary that gets around some of the restrictions of the compiler, then you've got the whole OS to play with.
Sure.
Is that, yeah.
Well, yes. Well,
that's the other side of, you know, putting these barriers around all of these processes and doing what Apple's done, which, you know, providing, requiring, not permissions, the sandbox stuff as well. So I'm not entirely convinced, but I will hold my judgment.
Well, so there's a few things there. So it's really a different story between whether or not you can touch other parts of memory. And like, you're basically at one point you're talking about like being able to bypass the verifier. and getting around that, right? So that, you know, obviously all software has bugs, but in generally, you know, and look at your browser, right? Every browser in the world executes JavaScript, and we've gotten pretty good at sandboxing JavaScript. I'm not saying that there aren't still leaks out there to be exploited, but you know, it's got. I remember when JavaScript first came out on web pages, I'm like, no way, right? Because I don't trust the programmers to keep the sandbox at all. And that was proven now in the, I think, the initial years, where it's like they found a lot of exploits. But pretty much, like, I haven't heard of a JavaScript-based exploit in ever. I mean, there's definitely weird things where you can, like, read CSS things, where you can try piece together people's page history. But in terms of, like, be able to reach out in the browser and, like, read a file system type stuff, that seems to be pretty rare. At least I haven't heard about it for a long time. The second thing that you mentioned is, like, you know, like, reading your address book or something like that. See, that's very interesting, because you get rid of the idea of address-based separation and that protection, doesn't mean that you just can that it's a free for all, right? Because in order for these processes to communicate, you still need to have a channel to communicate to, which is it's a system called capability object model. There we go. And the idea is that that if you have a malicious program that wants to read the address book, and so in order to even get running at all on Singularity, you would need to your binary at least has to look behaved. That I mean, it can't just try to fool the verifier. Or so you need to at least, you know, be well behaved. So you get running, and you're like, aha, I'm going to read the user's address book. But at that point, you need to talk to whatever process is responsible for vending the address book to you. And at that point, just like on the Mac, the program can put up a dialog box saying, hey, do you want this new program to actually allow me to vend your address book to it? So this all kind of boils down to a very fundamental computer science-y concept called unforgeable references, which are very important and unfortunately are not very well represented in today's software systems. Obviously, if you look at Objective-C, we are still using raw pointers. That means I just can I can mint a pointer and I can at address, let's say 1024, so I don't trip the page zero. And, well, actually, it have to be probably 4K above that. But anyway, I can start reading arbitrary memory. Now, granted, it's my own process, so this is less than useful. But you know, if you're loading a plugin, that means that plugin can do whatever it wants.
Do whatever it wants, yeah. So I tend to saute my pointers instead of just having them raw. But it's yes. Personal taste.
All the security mechanisms of that is actually, in my mind, is actually more secure, because with a capability object model system, you kind of have to whitelist everything. So when your little binary starts executing, and it needs to be introduced to the world, and there's probably some sort of like bootstrap or boot, like parent child forking thing going on there, where it's you get started, and the parent process hands you a reference, an unforgeable reference, and says, here you go, this is how you talk to the world. And you probably talk to your parent, saying, hey, I really would like to talk to the address book. At that point, the parent is making the policy decisions on whether or not you talk to the address book at all. And of course, then it can present the UI. And there's really no way for the program to forge a reference to any other part of the system, the file system, the network, or what have you. So sandboxing is what we have in iOS and macOS 10 today is kind of the opposite of that, where we had all these system services provided, and then we added we had the ability to turn those off. And I don't know how it's implemented at the very lowest level, but historically that's how it was implemented. That we had all these things that you could do willy-nilly, and then we had the ability to turn them off. Now, like I said, in the implementation level, it might be that everyone starts off with zero entitlements, and then it gets added on. So that would be a kind of a whitelist model, where you start off with not being able to do anything, and you get these entitlements to do more and more. But you can see where I'm going with this, that these capability object model systems kind of start with the whitelist kind of idea that your program can't do anything unless it actually can make friends and influence other programs. Okay, so I talked a little bit about the performance impact. So this is why I say like static analysis is so very interesting. I think it's going to basically like the idea of kind of VMs as we know them, I think are going to become less and less powerful, or at least less common. In that, it turns out that this activating the TLB, the transition look side buffer in your processor, that this is the part of the processor that's responsible for every time you make a memory address access. This is where the microprocessor looks to try to figure out what the physical address is and whether it should be allowed. And using this TLB is actually, you know, for what it does, it's amazingly cheap, because essentially you're taking all of your computer's memory, you're dividing into something like 4K chunks, and then you're assigning permission bits on them, whether it's readable, writable, executable, that type of stuff, and then providing essentially arbitrary mappings to all this gigs and gigs and gigs of virtual memory, and mapping it onto physical memory. And I mean, it's actually quite amazing that it's as performant as it is, but it ends up costing between 3% and 38% of your processor speed, and it tends to be on the lower side, I think, on x86 type stuff. But this is obviously a performance disadvantage that could be, if you would run a system without the TLB enabled, without virtual memory enabled, then obviously you get a nice tidy speed boost. And with a static analysis, you can take these executables, these set of instructions, and you can pop them into memory, set the program counter to them, and thus go. And knowing that this behavior, that the program will be well behaved. So this
is you saying when this system, you don't need virtual memory anymore?
Right.
Get out of it.
Yes. So virtual memory gives us two benefits, really. It gives us multiple address spaces, so that's where we get the protection domain from. But it also gives you the ability to have more memory than you have physically installed. So my MacBook that I'm speaking to now has 4 gigabytes of memory, and that's comparatively small, but it's acting like a machine that has many more than 4 gigabytes installed. And that's because virtual memory can, you know, swap to disk and all that. So obviously, at that point, if you want to act like a system has more memory than it does, then there is no satisfying that. However, there is a definite march on towards more cores, so many more cores in your system. And towards that, so I guess this MacBook Air says it has 4 cores. I happen to know that that's actually this doing hyper-threading, so it has 2 physical cores, but we're getting more and more cores in our system. And as we're doing that, we're actually moving towards what's known as a non-uniform memory architecture. And so the big thing used to be this thing called symmetric multiprocessing, SMP, and where every processor on the system would be able to share memory, and all the memory would look alike and would be symmetric. It would be would take about the same amount of time to access. Modern Intel architecture now has the non-uniform memory architecture, where you still can access memory any way you want, but if you access it in ways that don't kind of match the underlying hardware, you're going to take a performance hit. And I think that in the coming years, this is just going to get worse and worse with the many-core architecture. So when you have 100 cores going at a time, that I don't think each one of those will have 4 gigs of memory that they access themselves. They're probably going to maybe have maybe 512 megs or something, or maybe, if we're lucky, maybe a gig per core. And at that point, you know, the lack of virtual memory is not really an issue, because you actually do want to deal with the physical memory there. I don't know if that makes a whole lot of sense to you. See what I'm getting at there?
Well, yeah. Why does it make sense then? If they only have a gig per core, and the core needs to basically, you know, you got one core that's basically running your app, running Photoshop, you know, you want to have, you know, 2 gigs available for your large files that you're trying to display and edit.
Well,
why is that okay?
Yeah, my point is that the virtual memory then is actually working against the hardware architecture that we know about. Mm-hmm. So and if you have your Photoshop and you, for God help, you have a 2 gigabyte image or something, I don't, you know, I'm not.
Well, yeah, I mean, or you're loading lots and lots of images for a magazine or something, right? That managed to be larger than a gig's worth.
Yeah, right. So it's like, so you obviously you have the, you know, the Photoshop filters then, and they have their working set. So you have the code that has to be on the processor for the filter itself, and you have to have the pixmap representation of the Photoshop thing, and you have like maybe a before and after for undo or something. I don't know, but at that point, if you're going towards a architecture that kind of embraces more core and the non-uniform memory architectures, then at that point you already have to start breaking up your Photoshop pixmaps into fragmentary representations, because it doesn't matter whether you're running Singularity or not. That just to fit the modern memory and modern hardware architecture, you're going to have to break things up. And I happen to know that Photoshop under the covers does break up you look at a big image in Photoshop and you're like, oh, this is one big image, but actually it is broken up to, I forget what the pixel dimensions are, but they do break them up to like 512 by 512 chunks, and I believe they do that for parallelization reasons and for also for memory pressure reasons. But so those, right,
I mean, Photoshop was, from what I remember, they had their own virtual memory system before OS X did, so they were dealing with these sorts of things. They've been dealing with these sorts of things for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
in a way that you might expect an OS to do, simply because they need so much performance and real estate and whatever.
Mm-hmm. And also along the kind of the more core ideas, where you have 100 or 1,000 cores in your computer, is that Singularity has this concept of the subservient kernel, where we kind of think of kernels as kind of like the big boss in charge that kind of directs traffic and makes everything go around. And the idea here is that if you have this many-core kind of system where you have 1,000 cores on a processor, that these processors are going to be much less powerful and are probably going to be much more memory constrained and resources constrained. So the idea is that you can kind of whittle down what a kernel does to they get it as low as 12 kilobytes in size. And at that point, all it's really doing is kind of this coordinating with the other kernels amongst the other cores, and it in terms of trying to figure out where it should send messages to. And so it pares down the responsibility of the kernel significantly. So at that point, all the kernel has to do is kind of manage a process and maybe a set of threads, acquire release memory, and send and receive messages, and try and figure out where the messages should go. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit more about the state machine type stuff. So, Sync Sharp allows you to have declarative state machine in terms of the communication stuff. So, I'm sorry. I actually talked about that, didn't I, with the file type stuff. The file open, the kind of state machine of when you go through?
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm kind of skipping around my notes here. There's some other stuff here. Like, they have a weird typed assembly language, and they also have some interesting concepts in terms of compile time reflection. But mostly, I kind of want to more address kind of like the political aspect of Singularity and kind of its predecessors, which would be largely something like Mach and L4. So,
hopefully this will tie into what you want to talk about.
Sure. But
I guess this is all pretty new to me, so I'm not sure I have a good overall sense of what the big benefits of this are.
Okay, so the big benefits are that it assumes a hostile code environment, which I think is a pretty good assumption. The idea that the only code it executes is something that has been verified and to be correctly behaving, And because of the capability object model, that the only things it can talk to are the things that are explicitly allowed. So it's kind of like a whitelisting type thing. And I think that's a pretty good fit for how we use software today, which is pretty much all of it is downloaded off the internet.
Right, and it also makes sense for a Microsoft division to spend a lot of time on that.
Oh, why is that?
Well.
Oh, that's because of their ongoing security problems?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, they've definitely cleaned up their act. I remember they were obviously the laughing stock there for a long, long, painful period of time. But
right.
I mean, they've
patched it. They've patched it in the ways that they can with a conventional OS. But you're saying that now they've built it in to the logic from the ground up in a way that they probably couldn't before.
Right. Yeah. I first got interested in Singularity a while back. And so I did a little bit of research before going on here, and it looks like they have this new project called Midori, and which isn't that like a green liquor? It's like actually kind of tastes bad. But anyway, from what I understand is that it's Midori is kind of like the candidate for like the next version of Windows. So obviously they are talking about. It seems like I think this is all kind of. You know, not publicly disclosed yet, but it seems like the kind of ideas that are available in Singularity, which is downloadable, you can download it today and run it. It's past like the thing where it's like, oh, when these ideas sound good, it's like something you can actually download and run and try it out. It sounds like
as long as it runs Windows 95 programs, sure.
I know you just want to run like DOSBox and run your textual venture games. But so in terms of and so it assumes a hostile code environment where I don't think it really talks about where code is coming from, but I like the idea it assumes a hostile code environment. Now obviously sandboxing as we know it today kind of does the same thing, you know, with code signing. Obviously Mac OS X runs non-signed code, but obviously things like iOS require signed code. And so it's totally something that you can bolt on. This requires more resources. And then the entire thing where with the, they call them software isolated processes. These are the things that are the processes where are statically analyzed to be well-behaved so they can be run at ring zero without even VM being turned on. Obviously, this is a performance benefit. It's more efficient to be able to run with the TLB turned off. So it might give you, I don't know, maybe half an hour more of a battery life on your iOS device if you didn't have to maintain a TLB. And but mostly, you know, I like this from a ideological perspective. The how much it actually like provides you in terms of what we could end up bolting onto a Unix work-alike, you know, obviously we can, and we have. So, you know, to me, it's the architecture of the capability object model that's the most interesting in terms of how you can structure things to have a fine-grained permissions-based model, where sandboxing right now is very coarse-grained, and because it operates at the process level, where capability right. object mm-hmm. model works at the object level.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, and that... Oh, yes, I want to talk a little bit about the political aspects of this. The interesting thing is that message passing seems to be a common thread through all the kind of the operating system research here. And it's interesting to me because Mach is obviously kind of the predecessor to this, and we're all running Mach on our Macs and on our iPhones.
Right.
And so it kind of, for me, it makes me wonder what went wrong that, you know, kind of, you know, obviously we have things like Apple Events and stuff like that in terms of inter-process communication.
For now.
For now. We have XPC on top of Mach 2, so it's not totally going away. But it's kind of weird because, like, it seems to have not gone as well. Like, it seems like I kind of think this ties into the operating systems being so stagnant, is that no one really wanted to write programs that could take advantage of fine-grained messaging. And I think a part of this is because mock messaging is a real pain in the butt. I don't know if you've looked into it much, but there's these things called mock interface generator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've looked into it a bit. And I also, I mean, I've even talked with people at Apple who freely admit that, you know, I mean, not on the record or anything, but yeah, that's it. No one, no, don't use it.
Right.
Know.
Right. There's a reason why you have Apple Vents and stuff like that, and why they did not embrace mock. And so messaging on mock is a big pain in the butt. So obviously, you know, that's not going to get too much traction. And considering that it was tied to mock specifically and is non-portable to other operating systems, it's like there really was no take up on it. So,
well, and also I would say the one thing that I remember from that time period is that, you know, OS X was extremely slow when it started off. And there were a lot of people who blamed the fact that you had to do all of this extra messaging that no other operating system needed to do because they didn't have a microkernel. And so people, you know, people really got kind of mad at that. Well, hey, can't we get off of mock and do something else? Because all you've got on top of it is a Unix layer. You're not really using it. Mm-hmm. And while I don't know this for a fact, I would, you know, you say, well, why did we stagnate? And it could be that the engineers, you know, running mock, running that, developing it, you know, heard the message loud and clear that, you know, whoa, we don't want innovation at that level if it's going to keep us from being able to run our OS fast enough to be competitive. And so they might have said, well, okay, we can't build that out. We can only build out the stuff that's on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. So one of the interesting things about Singularity that I didn't mention that I must be buried in my notes somewhere here is that because everything runs at ring zero, they also do this interesting thing where as part of the verification process or something like that, is that they can guarantee when that only one person is pointing at a given chunk of memory. So when they do a message pass, they can you hand off a chunk of memory to another part of the system. And so they don't need to do memory copy. And so this ends up being a kind of a really cheap way to do messaging. And I don't know if you there's this thing called, I was just looking at it, darn, but I won't be able to remember it off the top of my head. But there's this entire thing about moving, in Linux, moving Ethernet drivers up into user space, TCP drivers, TCP software into user space. So you don't have to, so for every chunk of data you want to push through onto the wire, that you don't have to suffer the address context, the page swaps, not really page swaps, but the address context, address space context switch time. You know.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, so Singularity with its structure allows basically this really fine-grained objects to talk to each other in a very secure way that's actually faster than what we have today. And that said, you know, yes, it's more efficient. Yes, it's faster. Yes, it's arguably a better architecture. But that's obviously something that we kind of can bolt it on to the systems we have today. Not as well, but it does. And obviously, the systems that we have today are all running all the software we want to run. So I don't know if it will ever be actually, you know, if we get a new kernel that ends up, like, obviously the iPhone would have been a great thing for something like Singularity, right? Because a new platform running new software that is compatible with nothing.
And well, Microsoft will be porting it to the iPhone, yes?
Yeah, well, doesn't Microsoft like invalidate all your previous software with each new Windows mobile?
So now I'm just imagining them trying to put this under Windows Phone 9.
Right, pretty much.
You know, it'll kill what's left of the platform. Yeah, write all your software. You know, write all your software for a third time.
Right.
And now you'll have some success with it.
Yeah. This Apple, we're kind of, you know, it seems like Apple puts us on a pretty bad treadmill there, but that was definitely like an entire like plays for sure thing, them dropping that. And Microsoft has had some bad years here. Not undeserved, but yeah.
Well, it makes the image that comes to mind for me is, you know, you've got like a submarine that's got hatches, you know, as the way to get people in and out of it. And that's the current OS. And, you know, the new thing that you're talking about, they want to drill holes in the hull for the individual objects to get through. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because they don't have a way of closing them again, it's leaky. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I I don't think that's a good analogy. I see. I sense resistance to this idea.
Okay.
Of running everything at ring zero.
But I do think that, you know, Apple would have very little interest in bolting something like this, in trying to evolve the OS to do something like this, if they couldn't do it if they couldn't, you know, run all their existing software pretty much the same way. Right, like they're not gonna make any more big breaks.
Right. Like I said, opera systems are stagnant. People, yep. You know, they think this is what they do, and they design either below them or above them, and we just let the Unix-based operating system lives on. Yeah. With, you know, a little bit of sandboxing here, a little bit of Grand Central's dispatch there.
Yep,
that's it for me.
Okay. Well, so, and I'm assuming that you'll have lots of links for the show notes.
You got it.
On all the stuff, because it's very interesting. So, okay, cool. So please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes, and more. You can also find us individually on Twitter, me, A Pontius, APONTIOUS, which is also my username on app.net, although I'm not really checking app.net anymore, and Wolf, his last name, Wrench, that's the word rent, RENT, plus Z, plus SCH. See you next time.